Climate change, politics, the economy, is life driving you crazy? This week on Reality Check, we have Philip Menkes, a PhD sociologist and educator, to help give a perspective in these challenging times. Hi, Philip. Thank you for being here.
Hi, Lee. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, my pleasure. I'm really excited about this because, for one thing, I think for some reason, a lot of people are feeling right on the edge these days, and finding a way to have perspective on all the change and challenge of life right now is really helpful.
I certainly agree. I find myself every day thinking about these issues and worrying about the future.
Yeah, yeah. And knowing how to not put your head in the sand and be proactive and yet not let the kind of overwhelming quality of so many factors spinning what looks like out of control can be really overwhelming and give a person a sense of hopelessness and helplessness.
I certainly agree. It certainly feels overwhelming to me, too.
Yeah. So on a personal note, your studies have given you a kind of a macro vision about change and the kinds of things people are going through nowadays. Do you want to elaborate a little more specifically about what those things are that really interest you these days?
Yeah, so I got my doctorate in sociology from the University of Oregon, mm-hmm. and I emphasized environmental sociology, which studies human societies and their interactions and impacts on the environment. And my specific focus looked at agriculture and at a cross-national level, looked at how developing societies in particular, as they try to sort of catch up with the rest of the world, found themselves actually further degrading their environments as a result to do that. And so that was my initial take. Now, today I spend most of my time teaching. I teach at the community college south of us, at College of the Redwoods. Mm-hmm. And I also include environmental sociology in that curriculum as well. And so in that context, most of my efforts have been in helping students to pay attention to the social dimensions of environmental issues. It's pretty common for people to have an understanding of some of the technical issues. We understand mm-hmm. that industrial capitalism releases a lot of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere and so forth, and people tend to be more familiar with arguments about overall population growth. We have exponential population growth, which basically correlates almost directly with fossil fuel consumption and carbon dioxide emissions. But the social dimensions, I think, are oftentimes poorly understood, as the social psychological dimensions. And so we tend to focus on that.
So when you say the social psychological dimensions, talking about how individuals are responding or groups of people? Are we talking about climate deniers here, that group?
All of that, really. Because mm-hmm. we can, at the very big level, the macro level, we can look at, let's say, nation states as a proxy for societies mm-hmm. and see how nation states respond to the scientific knowledge and the perception of environmental change that may be devastating for the society itself. It's kind of difficult you think about, these are like large boats and they have to turn very slowly.
So we
now know, after more than 50 years of research, that climate change is real. It's human induced. We know that. But the interesting thing to me is that even though that knowledge is out there, there's still a socio-political fight over its severity, its potential risks, and what to do about it. Mm-hmm. And that's where the sociological lens comes in handy.
You feel like the argument about whether it's real and whether humans are causing it is sort of settled?
Well, I think with the consensus of near consensus of the world's scientists who are actually qualified to weigh in on this, I think, yeah, it is.
Yeah, that's my understanding.
The American public, it's not.
Okay.
And this is there's a long history behind this. First of all, I think we should know that most Republicans and Democrats, let's just say those two parties, of the electorate, the people in the country, in 1992, we agreed, people of these two persuasions agreed that climate change was real and it was probably already happening. Mm-hmm. So that was coincides with the 1992 Rio de Janeiro Earth Summit. Mm-hmm. Just 4 or 5 years prior to that, we had James Hansen's talk to Congress, his testimony. And there was big public movement. The environmental movement had basically successfully persuaded people that this is an issue. Well, after that point, there was a counter movement, which came largely from conservative think tanks. Mm-hmm. And that counter movement was basically designed to do three things: to question the validity of the science and of the scientists themselves, to convince people that even if the planet was warming, it wouldn't be that bad. And even if it turned out to be bad, it was too difficult to do anything about it.
So why did that happen? Can you say?
Okay, so the research I'm citing here is from Aaron McCrite and Riley Dunlap, and they did an analysis on this. Institutions like the Heartland Institute, for example. And the reasoning, I think, is it's manifold. Based upon what I've read, in the 1970s, the conservative movement was concerned largely about political developments that were sort of, in their view, liberalism, and sort of the free market ideology they felt was going by the wayside. Mm-hmm. And so they saw this as, I mean, if you take them on face value, mm-hmm. as big government, socialism in a green mask, you know, the wall had fallen, and so communism was no longer a genuine threat. Uh-huh. Also, we were quickly moving towards ratification of the Kyoto Accord in 1997.
Right.
And the publications amplify, they pick up speed right up leading to that. So it was a very well-funded and campaign to bring the question of whether climate change was real or not to bear. And the effects of that is they were very, very successful. So in 1992, the majority of Americans, regardless of Republican or Democrat, they agreed. Historically, Democrats have always shown greater concern for the environment than people identify as Republicans, just based mm-hmm. upon the data and from the 70s onward. But around the early 90s, especially in 94, there's a divergence first of the political elites. If you look at the League of Conservation Voters and the way they track the voting records of Senate and the House at the federal level, and basically, it's interesting, although there's a divergence or there's a difference between the two, over the years, they kind of track each other. So if they go up, both parties go up. If they go down, both parties go down. So going up meaning in favor of environmental policy and spending money in order to do something about it. But it begins to diverge in the early 90s, and dramatically so that most Democrat or, I guess you could say, liberal persuasion senators and Congress people, they continue to see the environment as an issue, where Republicans have gone way, way down. So the gap between the two has grown considerably in the last 20 years.
So your explanation is one of philosophy of the party. When I talk to lay people, they will often just blame the oil industry, the petrochemical industry.
No, actually, that is correct. I mean, it's not. So I think ideology and philosophy is meaningful to some, especially the intelligentsia within mm-hmm, the counter mm-hmm. movement. But these think tanks are funded by very rich people, as well as the American Petroleum Institute, for example.
Right.
The irony is that you probably already know this, but if you've read Inside Climate News about Exxon knew back in 1981 and 1980, really publications in 81 and 82, internal documents, which they were leading the modeling of the relationship of CO2 and temperature. And they were aware that this would be an issue.
It's their business to know.
And then they changed, they did an about face. Mm-hmm. So rather than divesting from petroleum and developing alternative technologies, they actually sort of doubled down and they ended up creating these sort of these unconventional fossil fuels, for example, fracking, tar sands. So they further investment in that, as well as contributing to, really, I think of it as a disinformation campaign.
One wonders why they made that choice. Is it just simply a matter of getting quick returns for the shareholders? You know, what motivated them to go in that direction?
I've thought about the same question, and I think shareholder return is definitely a player in this. And there might be sort of, I guess, anti-communitarianism, I think, is really part of the ideology, mm-hmm. like it's sort of like the rugged individualism part of it. But also there is, I think, two other things to consider. And I say them sort of cautiously because I haven't read anything on this, but I'm speculating here. One is that if you think about what these companies' investments are in, it's in how to get a liquid out of the ground mm-hmm. and to convert it. And so all this capacity, all this physical capacity
yeah.
and the investments, as well as the proven reserves that are already there.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that part. Second, I'm speculating here, but I believe it only recently that some of the transportation issues are alternatives to transportation that would be much more efficient can rival the fossil fuels.
Mm-hmm.
And then third, there's a geopolitical component to this.
Mm-hmm.
If you consider the United States an empire,
yeah.
and if you consider oil to be a strategic reserve, then it would make sense that there would be sort of an international rivalry over oil.
Right.
And if you look at the major oil, not the oil producing countries, but the countries that have the major oil companies, they're largely the United States,
yeah.
Great
yeah.
Britain, a handful of others.
So it's back to turning the Titanic, and it just sounded like it was going to be way too much work and too much loss
yes.
of profit.
I'm assuming that would be, giving the best, you mm-hmm. know, reading I can of that.
So do you have any commentary about how they became so effective at making half the country become a climate denier,
mm-hmm.
or at least disbelieving it, how they did it and why it was so effective?
Okay, well, how they did it was through a large number of policy think tanks, really. And
mm-hmm.
So there's a considerable list. I already mentioned the Heartland Institute, and there are others. So as I mentioned before, there's a list probably of around, I think it's 20 to 30 think tanks that all began publishing papers, books, and eventually public talking points, going on television, and sort of questioning the validity of the science. And creating the sense that although the science is uncertain, there's a relative uncertainty to climate science, it is certain that it would be devastating if we did something about it. So there's that part. The second is that by part of the explanation is that the media themselves, trying to be neutral,
mm-hmm.
gave
them that platform
to a minority voice. Really, that was, these were individuals who weren't necessarily qualified scientists
mm-hmm.
in this regard to match the world's best climate scientists.
Yeah.
This is the part I find the most ironic.
Like the old Time magazine thing where, well, these guys say this, but those guys say that, and they just, you know,
right.
act as though it's a 50-50 proposition
right.
when it isn't.
And giving equal airtime
mm-hmm.
pretty much to like a vast minority position
yeah.
here. It's a great irony to me. People will step on an airplane. They have absolute confidence in the science that leads to the, you know, aeronautics.
Mm-hmm.
But a climate scientist is somehow suspect. Somebody
right.
working for the oil industry, a scientist working for the oil industry, well, they're just doing their job, and they may be trying to promote their career. But promoting their career is the nefarious task of a client scientist. And so it's this, it's really, I think it's just propaganda.
And, you know, any scientist will say everything is uncertain because that's the nature of science, is right. to keep proving and reproving or disproving things over and over again.
Right.
And so when a scientist is challenged, well, is this for absolutely 100% certain, sure, he's got to say no.
Right. No, there's no certainty, of course, but there's always probability.
Yeah.
Right. And there's also prediction.
Right.
And so the climate models, their predictions are bearing fruit, and we're seeing the effects now. Yep. So, I mean, I think if the hard part, you asked me the question about climate denial and the so-called skeptics, and I think this is where it gets a little bit more interesting. The answer is both political and social psychological, I think. The political part is that party leadership went a particular direction, and then as basically sorting along party lines, people with a particular affinity began to hear and began to believe what their party leaders were telling them and began to follow suit with their attitudes and opinions. Same thing left and right. That's not that different. The social psychology of this, though, sort of begs the question, well, you know, how is it or why is it that one individual may sort of adhere to something even though they're getting evidence to the contrary? So why continuously say it's a hoax? Why continuously deny the possibility of it, so forth, even though you're getting information to the contrary? And this is where we get into sort of perceptual biases, which everybody has. We use our reference groups, our in-groups, and we have sort of an investment in those groups, and then we use them as a source of information. So when you face uncertainty, it's hard for you, getting mixed news data, especially if you're just relying on social media, you're not really getting well filtered, well organized news. Then the thing you do, if it's overwhelming and you don't have the time, or you maybe don't have the science to understand it, is you just go to the people that you trust,
right?
Who are the people who are like you. Right. And so I think that's a part of it.
And the other part is, you want things that are consistent with what you already believe.
Yes. Confirmation bias, what we call that. It's you look for information that confirms your existing beliefs, and you discount information that doesn't. You know, and again, that runs on either side of the political spectrum.
And it's only gotten crazier in the last few years with the cable stations being so dedicated to one perspective or another.
Right. Yes, agreed. So, you know, when we're looking at this sort of the data smog that we all live in, and the difficulty of trying to swim through all that and make sense of it, then it's understandable how people may rely on these heuristics, basically, to make their decisions about what they believe.
Yeah. You're listening to KCIW LP, Curry Coast Community Radio, 100.7 FM in Brookings, Oregon. Just in case anybody just tuned in, we're here with Philip Menkes discussing climate denying at the moment and many other things. So in terms of where we are now and how you see this thing playing out with deniers and maybe how to cope with deniers, have you developed some theories about that?
Well, okay, so not necessarily full-blown theories, but let me try. First of all, I think one area of hope is that millennials are different. Most of the climate denial comes from people who are 55 and older. And so millennials are a new voting bloc. They're a new group. So I think that they hold out hope. I think that they take it seriously. They don't want to live in an apocalyptic world. They see what's happening already. I think that they're more scientifically literate as a whole. And I don't think they're willing to fall for the it's inevitable argument. And so...
that's so good to hear.
So I think that's a big part of that. The other part is, eventually, even the most staunch deniers, I think, are going to have to face that something's happening. And this is where I find it interesting, because in my family... I have people who are themselves are deniers. I'm not, obviously. And I think about, well, how do people build trust and systems of reciprocity and resilience? How do we sort of find that common ground and that common basis? We can debate about appropriate policy, but at some point we're all going to have to find a way to sort of survive through this. I mean, I personally am not sanguine about what this is going to look like. And
yeah.
What it's not just going to be a hotter world and more dangerous in terms of climate. It's going to be, perhaps, it could be a meaner and uglier world.
Oh, yeah.
And so this is where I think of some of the preppers, you know, reaching mm-hmm. out to them going, okay, you folks are pretty good about thinking about your enclave and your household and your food supply and so forth. Mm-hmm. But I like to think of this thought experiment. I use the Cascadia subduction zone as an example.
Yeah.
If we had a major event like that, the news I'm hearing is it could be months, maybe years before we even have simple utilities in place.
Yeah.
So unless you want to live in an apocalyptic world of the Walking Dead, it's in everybody's interest to do more than just simply try to retreat into an enclave and fight everybody off, and you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I think that's my opinion on that. So I think that there's a basis to talk about. We think of this is this global problem. We need global solutions. We need state actors involved. We need international agreements, or folks like, we don't want anything to do with that, national sovereignty and so forth. Well, when the effects are happening, and they are happening, and when they get worse, which I believe they will, it will be in everybody's interest to have already planned local resilience in the
exactly.
face of that.
Exactly. And that's where it really comes down to the community level, you know, and especially here where we're so cut off from everything else. It doesn't take much before we're out of groceries, we're out of gas, we're out of everything. And if electricity goes down, I mean, it just gets pretty bleak pretty quick.
There's a robust literature that shows that the communities that have the highest social capital, connections, linking mm-hmm. different groups and different constituents and people within that community, those are the ones that are able to endure disasters like hurricanes, tornadoes, yeah. floods, and so forth. So that research is already building up. And so we kind of have an idea of what to do. It's at least it's an emerging picture.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that, you know, we can look at globally some of the things that are going on. These mass migrations are being driven by climate. And there's so many other kinds of effects other than it's just warmer or colder or whatever the change happens to be in your neighborhood that's driving a lot of chaos that's going to be coming our way. And we need to be ready for that. We need to adapt.
And that's going to be, and that brings us back up to national policy again. Mm-hmm. I personally think that if a candidate is not only taking seriously the climate issue, but has a plan to do something about it, then that candidate's not worthy of office and not worthy of leadership.
Yeah.
And so that's, I mean, there's a, to me, is a, that's a litmus test, a big litmus test in a political candidate, as
I
far
agree.
As I'm concerned.
Yeah. I was going to say, too, you're working with those millennials and even younger people, I mm-hmm. suppose.
Right.
And you're seeing in your classrooms where their head is at in terms of all of this. And it was very exciting to hear you say, oh, they're not defeated and overwhelmed by this, which is, I wish I knew how they did that.
Mm-hmm.
But you're really seeing that in the classroom and on the campus.
To some extent, yes. I mean, and I'm talking about millennials as a whole, you know, statistically
yeah.
speaking. But
mm-hmm.
But that does bring up an interesting dimension here.
Uh-huh.
And if you think of ourselves, we're living in a rural community.
Yes.
Right? And this community and many like it have historically existed on extractive industries,
mm-hmm.
mining and timber and fisheries. Right.
Right.
And so I think we face sort of a crossroads now about how we move forward. And on the one hand, historically, people from communities such as this have been told, hey, your practices, what you do to make a living is threatening everyone. So you can't do that. Or it's really threatening habitat and species biodiversity and so forth. So we need to save the forest. So we have to sort of restrict and regulate. That creates this, I believe, this sort of reaction against that. Say, what are you? Who are you? To tell
me,
right.
My family's been doing that for three generations
right.
and so on.
So, but on the other hand, I mean, there is, I don't think maybe current practices are like that, but there are models out there for how to do things such as sustainable forestry mm-hmm. and sustainable fisheries.
Oh, and we've got some of our fishermen here in town are really thinking about that and
yeah.
applying those techniques. So I want to be sure not to paint them as being so old school that they're closed-minded. I mean, there are some that are, but there's some that are really progressive about it.
It's some of the old school
steps.
It's some of the old school folks who actually, I think, have the long-term knowledge and the mm-hmm. and sort of understand some of these issues.
That too.
It's going to be a multi-stakeholder approach.
Yeah.
But the thing I'd like to emphasize here is that part of what we have in this county, in this bioregion really, including the Chetco River, including the watershed and the forests and so forth, is we have buffers to climate change effects.
Mm-hmm.
Forests buffer climate change effects.
Can you explain that a little
bit? In part, they help to pull moisture out of the atmosphere and continue to have a drinkable water supply and salmon. But they also have temperature regulating effects. And so this is part of what can contribute to resilience.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if our long-term policies or long-term actions here as a community, if we're focusing on the resilience of our ecosystem
mm-hmm.
and building or, you know, perhaps creating or reforming our productive and consumptive relationships within that network, I think we could probably be a more habitable place,
mm-hmm.
let's say, than Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Right. I mean, we're not being threatened with desertification, for instance.
Right.
Or,
right.
You know, we're really quite blessed that we have the moderating influence of the ocean and a lot of things on our side already.
Right.
But one of the things you mentioned earlier that I'd really like to get back and hear more about is this whole idea of the resilient communities are the ones that have a lot of interconnection, if I understood you correctly.
Mm-hmm.
Can you say a little bit about what that is and how to foster it? Because
yeah.
I think that's really, you know, we are very polarized here. We're one of the highest voting communities in the country. And unfortunately, it's about a 50-50 split.
Mm.
You know, we're really very adversarial in some ways that I don't think is really healthy for us. It's good that we're voting, but
right.
how can we build our community better in that way you're talking about?
Well, I think what you're doing here, and I think what this radio station is doing is a great example of that, and
that's nice
reaching
hear.
Out and trying to establish dialogue. So, generally speaking, we have the question of how are you connected to other members in the community? You
mm-hmm.
can think of it as a network,
yeah,
right? And each individual is a node in that network. And some individuals are highly connected to many, many different other individuals. Some individuals are sort of bridges between different groups of people.
Mm-hmm.
And you can think of, you know, any person that you know and who they know and so forth. And then you can, that's one layer. Then the next layer are, what are the institutions that are there to provide to provide basic services? So, okay, we have our water. And so I live in Harbor, so we have the Harbor Public Utility District. Fire, we have police and so forth. We think of those as sort of the public institutions.
Mm-hmm.
But there's this other aspect we call civil society, in which organizations connecting with each other can create trust and reciprocity. Now, based upon what? Well, we live in a market society. Most of us are not really, I mean, I don't know what the percentage of people here working directly in extractive industries are, but many people will have other interests at stake, right? So then the question is, how do our institutions bring us together? I think that there's probably a lot of folks who might get connected to other people through their faith organizations, or they might get connected to others through some kind of civil club or just friendships and kinship networks and so
mm-hmm.
forth. So when we look at those different types of networks and different institutions, the question becomes, how do you sort of increase the degree of connectedness defined as people who know of someone else and by virtue of that relationship can provide access to or connection to shared or distributed resources, right? Mm-hmm. So, and I don't mean necessarily money or time. I mean more like knowledge mm-hmm. and
you have a problem here might be where you could connect with someone who could help you solve
it. Right. And my guess is that for some folks, they're more isolated. Others are much more connected. Mm-hmm. So consequently, if a community that has already thought about disaster preparedness, which I know this community has already prepared for it, already has roles in place, already has volunteers in place, that to me is a potential model for what happens when things become more difficult, just speaking mm-hmm. generally.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
One of the things that has long concerned me, well, first let me just say that the senior community here, which are mostly from other places, they've come here with their little nest egg or fixed income or whatever, and they're retired, and so they get here and they start organizing a club or joining this thing or that thing. People here are so engaged. Those people are. But there's also this other group of people that seem to have almost no contact with that group, who have lived here a very, very long time. There's some intergenerational poverty issues and things like that in that group. You know, used to be less than 50% of the kids would graduate high school here. I think mm-hmm. it's better now. Mm-hmm. But we've had these long-standing sort of social economic issues because it was such a poor town. And that group and this group, they could benefit so much from knowing each other, and yet doesn't seem like there's much interconnectedness there.
And when I think about this issue in particular, I think about people who are just every day just trying to live and make ends meet.
Exactly.
And work and raise a family.
Mm-hmm.
And so whatever type of resilience we're trying to achieve, it can't just be sort of like the extra slice of time that you don't have to give.
Right.
It sort of has to be woven into your daily lives. And I don't have any good answers exactly on how to do this.
No, but one of the things that some groups are thinking about, because this is a question that comes up pretty often in different circles that I've been in, is maybe what you do is you talk to the kids in the high school who do have the time and the, you know, curiosity, and help them to get more involved and participate and so on, and that they're going to be taking that home to their families, because they're the ones that actually have a little time. Once you start a family of your own until you're ready for retirement, you know, you're pretty committed.
Right.
And that makes it difficult for a lot of folks that don't have a job that necessarily allows for a lot of free time and so forth.
Right.
So anyway, that's one of the thoughts. But it seems like, you know, so much of what we need to do is simply getting dialogue going between groups.
And maybe that dialogue could be on environmental education. Mm-hmm. I mean, just talking about what we know about climate change and sort of getting those debates going. Because it's an interesting finding in the social science research is that the more educated you are, if you are a liberal or Democrat, the more you're persuaded by the climate science. But amongst conservative Republicans, the more educated they are, the less inclined they are to believe the climate science.
More educated in the conventional sense?
In the conventional sense, in sort of formal education. And so people who are very engaged in the debates, I think that would be an interesting forum to have, and not just in the newspaper, because you know how that goes down.
Right.
But really a place with, you know, ground rules and decorum and a way to, let's talk about the climate science here.
Mm-hmm.
That might be an aspect. I tend to like to give hope to the people who are already sort of there,
mm-hmm.
the people who aren't convinced. I haven't given up on them, but I feel at some point they're just going to have to come to terms with what's happening globally. What I like to say to my students is, it is overwhelming, but there are some things you can do.
Mm-hmm.
And one interesting finding is that around 70%, depends on how you measure it, of total greenhouse gas emissions globally actually come from household emissions. If you factor in all the emissions that go into creating certain products. So, and the main two areas that people have individual control over is transportation and diet, right?
And diet.
Yes. So the transportation issue, aviation, especially long distance flight, is a major, major contributor. And mm-hmm. so that's, you know, what do you do about that? I mean, that's difficult. And hopefully we can have a high speed rail system in this country one day, but we'll mm-hmm. see.
I hear people say things like one cross-country airplane trip is equivalent to all the gas you're going to burn this year.
Things like that.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm not sure exactly the statistic there, but it's some kind of an equivalency like that.
Right. And then, and then there's heating. Heating is a big one.
Mm-hmm.
And these are all household. And then there's diets. And so...
You thinking about meat eating and bringing in produce from far away, that kind of thing?
All of this factors in the distance mm-hmm. that the food has to travel, mm-hmm. What went into the production and the processing of the food. And so without mincing words, meat consumption is one of the major drivers
mm-hmm.
of really global environmental change of many aspects, including the fertilizer runoff that goes to feed the soy and the corn that goes to mm-hmm. feed the cattle and so forth. Now, having said that, a portion of that output is a result of the industrial process, production of meat, if mm-hmm. you call it right, and the long distance transport.
Yeah.
So people who say local consumption for local production, I think that there's something to that, and that's one way people can make sense mm-hmm. of that.
So there is a lot that can be done just by an individual.
I think there's, basically about half the required emission reductions to hit the 1.5 degree Celsius goal, mm-hmm. which is what the Paris Agreement said.
Mm-hmm.
About half of those reductions could come if households became more efficient in their energy use and consumption, and if transportation were to change. The problem is that they really, based upon what I'm reading and the research on this, is that they can't just do it alone. It can't just be voluntary. We need real policy frameworks to help establish the incentives to create that transportation system that isn't so energy intensive. Now, there's an interesting, there's like this fly in the ointment, though, and that... things like, let's say, a carbon tax, which is an example of maybe a policy instrument to try to make some change here. That's going to disproportionately impact rural people because we're so much more dependent upon automobile and truck traffic in order to be able to commute. I think about people just trying to get medical care, right? Mm-hmm. And how often we'll travel, let's say, to Medford, for example. Mm-hmm. So... The social justice component of this, the question of are we actually going to have policy initiatives that address all of the needs of all the different members of the community. They're not, in other words, not make one group of people sort of bear the weight of these changes.
Right.
That social justice component is not just about the poorer nations of the world. It's not just about the island nation of Tuvalu. It's about actually rural people and people living in poverty, throughout the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, that's when we address those issues, we might be able to see greater buy-in to things like the Green New Deal, for example.
Yeah, one of the things that I kind of came up against is, I'd like to use my car less and not have those emissions, but I live out of town. And I know in cities, millennials and young people, they just don't even have cars, a lot of them.
Right.
They live real near where they work, and there's a market they can walk to. If they want to go travel somewhere, they'll rent a car and carpool it with five people, and, they figure it out.
Right.
But here, it's kind of impossible not to drive, unless you're right in the middle of town.
Yeah, I think electric vehicles will...
That's going to make a huge difference.
Part of it. I mean, there's obviously a trade-off. You have to mine for the minerals to make the batteries.
You have to
do something with the batteries.
Yeah, that birth to the grave kind of chain of events is an influence in all these choices. And it's so hard to do, what do they call that, life analysis of different objects? But Yeah, it's going to make a huge difference. And I understand they're coming out with a bunch of new ones really soon.
Right.
Yeah. So we have just a couple of more minutes to talk about a whole bunch of things. I want to let people know, in case they're just tuning in, you're listening to KCIWLP, Curry Coast Community Radio, 100.7 FM in beautiful Brookings, Oregon. And before we get out of time, I really wanted to see what we could come up with in terms of that feeling of helpless and hopeless that individuals go through, and how can we maintain a sense of proactivity and not fall into despair? If you have any thoughts in the content that you're dealing with that can help us as individual folks.
Well, when it comes to not falling into despair, I'm not sure if I'm the best example of that. I've actually come to terms with the fact that for probably decades now, maybe that's an exaggeration, but at least recently, I grieve what's happening to the planet.
Oh, yeah.
I grieve what's happening to the wild and the green spaces that I knew growing up.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm actually from Western Maryland, and I grew up on a mountain, and you know, we had whippoorwills and deer and you know, fox and skunk and forests, and that area had been forested, and there have been impacts and so forth. But I had a sense, I had a taste, I think, early on, of this affinity for and this love for the natural world,
mm-hmm.
and really for the right of the rest of the species of this planet to just exist.
I so agree.
And so for me, like, the way I cope is I think I have a philosophy of, I guess you'd call it wholeness, that we're one with nature, we're not separate from it,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
that it's not something to be defeated, but something to live with.
Mm-hmm.
We are nature in that sense, mm-hmm. but and so, you know, that sort of gives me a sense of comfort, and it's the thing that I fall back on when I think, okay, in some sense, nature bats last, and that's not going to necessarily be good, maybe for human civilizations,
right?
But it may ultimately, it may force us to sort of change the way we do things.
Traditionally is man over nature,
right.
Not with nature.
Right.
But nature in the last is going to have the last laugh one way or the other. You know, we may not be there to see it, but, yeah. You know, life will go on the planet. We just might not be there. So how can we change that attitude to live in harmony?
Yeah, that's a great question. And in fact, there are people out there who really are sort of reasserting the dominion view that, you know, we've inherited in our culture, the idea of you have dominion over the earth, be fruitful, multiply, and that's sort of like, that's theologically necessary, and that somehow aligns with sort of this laissez-faire economic philosophy. And I think that, I mean, that's, I don't understand that. I don't see the viewpoint. I mean, we're the same, we all are made up of the same elements. All life is made up of the same DNA.
Mm-hmm.
All life is run on the same cellular machinery. And this is, we all have the same home. The atmosphere, one of the most interesting things to me is that the atmosphere, just how thin it really is.
Oh, yeah.
And yet how necessary it is for life support. So I think that there's this fundamental alienation between ourselves and the rest of nature.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that it's so deep in the structures of our society and the culture of our society,
mm-hmm.
that it's like a wound.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there's room for people who are called to be healers to address that trauma.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that helps anybody.
Well, the issue to me is that the split is so built into all of our structures, the split from nature,
mm-hmm.
that as individuals, we might start to heal that within ourselves, but our structures are just so, again, we're trying to move the Titanic on a real short time scale. So that's makes it really difficult. But I want to just say how much I appreciate what you're bringing forward here, because I think that's really at the heart of matters overall, how we got here, you know. So
infinite growth on a finite planet is impossible.
Right.
So we're either it's population or whether it's the accumulation of capital, they cannot just continue unabated.
That's true.
That's the crisis.
And, you know, in defense of human beings, we didn't realize that for a long time. But we definitely are here now. And I think part of the task as humans is to take care of our own inner ecology well enough by this kind of healing that we're talking about and whatever else it takes to be able to maintain a sense of well-being in the face of these challenges. And it's not about denying or putting your head in the sand. You know, you still need to be as proactive as you can, do what you can do. But now this is one of my little pet theories, that we in some ways have a lot of almost what I would call codependency, where we think we have to fix everything and that we feel very guilty and bad about ourselves if we can't. And that's asking more than we actually can do. And that sounds kind of defeatist, but in a way it frees a person up that you can do as much as you can do. And the rest of the time you have to keep your life in enough balance that you are capable of contribution. You get yourself so far down that you can't see the forest for the trees, you're going to just not be effective at anything, helping yourself or anybody else.
And from that perspective, maybe it's easier to weed through all the information and disinformation that's out there. It's easier to have greater clarity and equanimity and understanding what the stakes of the game are, really are. I mean, scientists are telling us we have 10 to 15 years left to really prevent the worst irreversible changes.
And that doesn't mean somebody flips a switch in 12 years.
Right.
First of all, 2 years of that is gone.
Yeah.
But also, that stuff is already happening.
Right, right.
You know, it's just going to, how bad is it going to get?
Yeah, and I think, though, that's in the end, at some point, the final analysis, at some point, laissez-faire does not work. And people have to get politically active. And we need to start seeing everybody as a member of one human family, and everybody in our nation as inclusive and part of an extension of me, as I am an extension of them. And that sense of interbeing, that's because, I mean, think about it. Here's the example I like to use. The first responders that every 5 years or so, John Stewart has to get up there and campaign for their health. And I think these are people who, in most circles, they're the highest status individuals you can think of, in the sense that these are people who really deserve our thanks and our gratitude and, frankly, our support. So then why is it so difficult to extend those appropriations to that group, that community? Do we see them as someone who's foreign and alien to us? Or are they our people? And I think this us and them, that's a big part of this. So we could, as you address the structures, how do we build these structures so that we're actually all relations?
And how do you communicate that on a simple level that most people can understand, the need for fusing this polarity that we seem to be living under, this adversarial attitude about us and them in so many different ways, not just politically, but all kinds of prejudices that we have. How do we communicate that and get that point across? I'm not really sure. Doesn't seem like, I mean, even the, quote, good guys seem to spend a lot of time in a very adversarial stance these days.
Oh, and what you mean by that, the good guys?
Well, I mean, you know, the people that are like pro dealing with climate change, for instance, the progressives that, you know, for the most part, I think of as being the good guys, definitely. But they're not just the good guys. You know, we need to not label some people good and some people not good. You know, we have common universal needs and common values that we all share. Mm-hmm. And somehow talking at that level sometimes gets us more communication than waving flags in our tiny little fists at the heavens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's probably true. And I think my sense is that the biggest fear amongst conservatives about doing anything about climate change comes from a fear of sort of a totalitarianism.
Mm-hmm.
That somehow it's the state exerting too much control.
They're going to take away my hamburger.
Over individual commerce, mm-hmm. and so forth, and private property and rights of exchange and so forth.
Right.
That's probably the biggest fear, and that's in part that's the political motivation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we need to disentangle that from the economic interests that are telling people that's going to happen to you if you support climate policy. The big irony to me is that, you know, some individuals would say, well, it's this, we need to sort of dismantle the state so that the corporate powers and the fat cats can't sort of take over and shove us around. But the state is the only vehicle that the people have for exerting any change.
Exactly.
So if you do that, then you've lost any power that you have over big business as it stands.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like maybe some new framing and some new alliances, and where we're able to bridge, to build that, I don't know what would be, trust, or let's look at what are the real policy initiatives in the Green New Deal. You know, what if you fear that this is socialism? Well, let's talk about what that really means.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it might just be as simple as there are some folks whose they've had their chance. They've had their chance for their political agenda, and it's failing us
mm-hmm.
as a community.
Mm-hmm.
So we need a new political agenda,
mm-hmm.
and that's just kind of the way the chips are going to fall.
And at the same time, I would say that there probably are parts of, for lack of a better descriptor, the Green New Deal or somebody else's policy out there that do need to be examined. I mean, it's a terribly complicated situation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You start talking about a minimum wage for every living person.
Right.
All these things, they have their ramifications in many different directions.
Right.
And, you know, we don't want to be disenfranchising one person to the benefit of another. So what is really fair? And all of that needs to be talked through. I think having the openness to talk about it in some detail and acknowledging that these systems aren't perfect that we're putting forward,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, help us figure it out, mm-hmm. is maybe one way to get some dialogue open.
Could be. I think you're right.
Build some trust.
And there's probably, I'm sure there's room for negotiation, and maybe some of those things that are asked for, really, those are just negotiable items that mm-hmm. go the wayside when it gets down to brass tacks.
Right.
But what's non-negotiable to me is we cannot just go it alone in this world. This country cannot go it alone. We need to get into some accord. And if the accords themselves, or the Paris Accord, is probably insufficient. It's acknowledgeably insufficient. Mm-hmm. But it needs to be something. We have had international agreements on sulfur dioxide emissions and on CFCs, and they have worked.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not impossible.
Exactly.
Right.
Well, and one of the other things that I think is in the mix here is strengthening democracy. People's actual understanding and belief in the efficacy of democracy. When you're talking about tearing up the government and, you know, then where are you at? I mean, if you're not voting, if you're not being an educated voter, you know, you're adding to the chaos and confusion. And it really is the best system that anybody's come up with so far. Ours needs a little tweaking in a lot of really important ways, but I think people have lost a lot of faith in democracy at this point, mm-hmm. and that's part of it.
Mm-hmm. More to come.
More to come. Well, we're down to our last few minutes here. I want to make sure that we talk about everything that's on your mind. Have you had any particular... it seems so new to have much research out there, but is there any information about how people are surviving all of these challenges and the despair. And I mean, it feels to me like suicide's up. There's a lot of measures that are kind of indicating that we're losing it here.
Hmm. Well, there's a phrase, Professor Kari Norgaard at University of Oregon, she uses the phrase organized denial.
Yeah.
And it's a social phenomenon. It's not individual denial in the sense that I don't believe in climate change. It's that I know what's going on, and yet me and my community, and we just don't know what to do about it.
Oh, that's so true.
Yeah. And so, you know, I don't have any real statistics or anything on responses like suicide in response to, you know, environmental stressors. I do know that environmental stressors have been pinpointed as related to perhaps, if not driving, making worse social conflicts. So for example, the conflict in Syria, one of the major issues was that they had a drought. Mm-hmm. And that drought drove people who were normally living off the land as basically herders and stuff, into the cities without any, you know,
no
livelihood.
No work, no support.
Right, right. So we know that environmental stressors can increase conflict, can increase migration, can mm-hmm. increase, you know, not just societal conflict, but international conflict. So,
and I think when people get that desperate, like you're describing the Syrian right. folks moving into the cities and
right.
not having any resources to fall back on, then they start grasping at straws. They're pissed off, they're frustrated, and there's nothing else to do but take to the street.
Right. Of course, yeah. And they're ripe for recruitment into whatever type of organization. So one of the aspects of the old New Deal from Roosevelt was in part to deal with the political agitation that the labor movement had as a result in part from the Great Depression. So it was like either we reform the system or we have to face the chaos as a result of the system. That's sort of the question. And part of that chaos could have been revolutionary, right?
Yeah.
Right. So under those, you know, under those circumstances, I think it's in the interest of freedom loving people to find ways to make this system work for everyone. It's in the interests of everyone to make the system work for everyone.
Well, that's really, really well said. And Philip, it's just been fantastic having you here. It's been such an interesting conversation. For those of you who don't know, that was Philip Mankus from the College of the Redwoods, PhD in sociology, who's been telling us all about what's going on in the world and how to cope with it. Thank you so much for coming. I really, really appreciate it. And thank you all for listening. This has been Lee Tooley with Pia White, our co-producer and technical support. And again, thank you for listening to Reality Check on KCIW.
The opinions expressed here are those of the individual participants. Curry Coast Community Radio takes no position on issues discussed in this program.